Dr. William Luther Pierce, the year 2000, Joe Lieberman and Judaism.
Hello. As you know, we spoke about the Jews last week, and so I really didn't plan to talk with you about the Jews again this week, but so many listeners have written to me about Al Gore's Orthodox Jewish running mate, Joseph Isidore Lieberman, that I guess we're obliged to deal once more with this very unsavory subject. I should say first that I do not share the alarm expressed by most of the listeners who have asked me to speak about the Lieberman nomination. The Democratic Party has been so thoroughly in the hands of the Jews for decades now that I believe it's a good thing for them to be out front, where they can be seen instead of continuing to pull the strings from backstage. It would be wonderful if George Bush, in his disgusting scramble to be inclusive, had chosen Elie Wiesel or some other high-profile Jew as a running mate, too. How about Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank? That would be really inclusive, someone who is both a Jew and an open homosexual. But then Frank would have to change his party affiliation from Tweedledum to Tweedledee. I mean, really, our whole electoral process in this television age has become so corrupt and unreal, such an embarrassing joke, that it is very difficult for me to take seriously any major party candidate, or even a minor party candidate. Did you see what Pat Buchanan chose as a running mate? And his rival in the Reform Party chose a Jew, just like the Democrats. And I hope that you don't believe that just because the Republicans are offering us two white males, neither of them Jewish or homosexual, the Republicans are in any way better than the Democrats or the so-called Reform Party. The Republicans just give us a different face out front and a different party line, a party line a little less disagreeable, perhaps, to sane, healthy white Americans than the Democratic Party line. But there's no chance at all that the Republicans will make any fundamental changes in the way the country is going. So that's why I say that it would have been good to have a Jew on the Republican ticket, too. Better for us to face reality now than continue to let ourselves be fooled by the old two-party shell game. Anyway, throughout the coming presidential campaign, you'll be able to observe the amusing spectacle of the Republicans trying to find a way to attack the Democrats without saying anything bad about Joe Lieberman from fear of offending the Jews. Actually, if you believe the information put out by the mainstream media about Lieberman since he's become Gore's running mate, there's nothing bad the Republicans could say about him. Both Newsweek and Time magazines this week are full of fawning praise for him. They call him the conscience of the Senate and hold him up as a paragon of virtue. Is that because Lieberman was one of the few Democrats who had the nerve to criticize Clinton for subjecting us all to the Bill and Monica show? No, criticizing Clinton was no display of morality. It was a display of the fact that Lieberman was one of the few Democrats who wasn't afraid of retribution from Clinton. Lieberman belongs to a more powerful gang than Clinton does. Lieberman is not just a nominal Jew. He is an observant, Orthodox Jew, a synagogue-going Jew who actually hires a Sabbath Gentile, a Shabbos Goy, to do the things a Jew is not permitted by the Jewish religion to do on Saturday. Lieberman is a Talmud Torah sort of Jew who takes the Jewish scriptures quite seriously. His biographical sketch in the August 8th issue of the New York Times lists studying the Torah as one of his principal interests. So what does that mean? What does the Torah command him to do besides not open any doors or flip any light switches on the Jewish Sabbath? Well, you know, I'm not a Talmud Torah scholar myself, but I have a book in front of me which was written last year by two Jewish professors, one of whom who has spent the last 40 years living in Jerusalem and becoming acquainted with such matters. The book is Jewish Fundamentalism in Israel, and the authors are Israel Shehak and Norton Mizvinsky. Their book is not so much about the details of the Torah and the Talmud as it is about the way Judaism actually governs the lives and influences the attitudes of religious Jews, of Orthodox Jews in Israel. It's pretty bizarre reading, with many examples of Jewish behavior dictated by religion that would be considered quite scandalous if generally known by non-Jews. There are several underlying themes to the behavior and attitudes of religious Jews. The most fundamental theme is that the Jews have been chosen by their tribal god, Yahweh, or Jehovah, depending on how you want to pronounce it, to own and rule the earth. One can see a quite explicit statement of this theme in the book of the Jewish prophet Isaiah. In the 60th and 61st chapters of Isaiah, the prophet raves that eventually all the wealth of the Gentiles shall be delivered to the Jews, that the Jews shall, quote, suck the milk of the Gentiles and, quote, eat the wealth of the Gentiles, while the Gentiles all become servants of the Jews. Or to use Isaiah's quaint mode of expression, the Gentiles shall, quote, stand and feed your flocks and, quote, be your plowmen and your vine dressers. The Talmud is full of elaboration and explication of this theme of the special nature and status of the Jews, of their being chosen to be the owners and rulers of the earth. It is the Torah, of course, the first five books of the Old Testament, which contains the basic Jewish doctrines, the doctrine of chosenness, for example. But it is the Talmud which explains exactly how the Torah is to be interpreted. And the Talmud's interpretation often is quite different from the bland and inoffensive interpretation accepted by those Christians, primarily fundamentalist Protestants, who also accept the Jewish Old Testament as Holy Writ. When the great reformer, Martin Luther, decided to produce a translation of the Bible into German in the 16th century, he wanted to be sure that he got it right. So he consulted the Talmud and was horrified by what he found there. He could not bring himself simply to reject the Jewish Bible altogether. So he clung to the traditional Christian interpretations and denounced the Jews in the strongest possible terms for their chauvinistic and hate-filled interpretations. In his book, The Jews and Their Lies, Luther wrote, and I quote, "The sun never did shine on a more bloodthirsty and revengeful people than the Jews, who imagine themselves to be the people of God and who believe that they should murder and crush the Gentiles. Do not their Talmud and their rabbis say that it is no sin to kill if a Jew kills a Gentile, but it is a sin if he kills a fellow Jew? It is no sin if he does not keep his oath to a Gentile. Therefore, to steal from a Gentile, as they do with their money lending, is a divine service. And they are the masters of the world, and we are their servants, indeed their cattle." End quote. Today, the leaders of the Lutheran Church, who are as much under the influence of the Jews as the leaders of all the other mainstream Christian churches, ignore the writings of their founder on the subject of the Jews and react with embarrassment when reminded of them. They pretend that Martin Luther didn't really mean what he wrote about the Jews and Judaism. That was nearly 500 years ago, and Luther was merely reflecting the prejudice of his times, they say. But in fact, the Talmud and the Torah today are exactly what they were 500 years ago. The Talmud and Torah that Joseph Lieberman studies today are the same Talmud and Torah that horrified Martin Luther at the beginning of the 16th century. The Lutheran officials may be afraid to admit that, but Professors Shadak and Mezvinsky aren't. They cite specific instances of the way in which the same Jewish teachings which Martin Luther preached against 500 years ago govern the lives of Orthodox Jews in Israel today. An outstanding example is that of Dr. Baruch Goldstein. Goldstein, a physician born and raised in the United States, was an Orthodox Jew. He immigrated to Israel and joined the Israeli army as a medical officer. In the army, he announced to his superiors that he would not treat wounded Gentiles. In 1985, after an Israeli soldier shot a Palestinian in the legs, the wounded Palestinian was brought to an army clinic in Hebron, where Goldstein was on duty. Goldstein refused to provide medical assistance to the Palestinian, and he issued a statement in which he said, and I quote, "I am not willing to treat any non-Jew." Goldstein's refusal to do anything to save the life of a Gentile was not just a personal quirk. It was based on an injunction in the Talmud, and Jewish religious authorities prevented the army from punishing Goldstein for his disobedience to orders. Specifically, Jewish religious law permits a Jewish physician to provide treatment to a Gentile only when refusal to do so might cause harm to Jews. For example, by alerting Gentiles to the Jews' true feelings toward them. Despite his refusal to provide medical assistance to Gentiles, Goldstein was permitted to remain in the army as a medical officer with the rank of captain, and in fact, he later was scheduled for promotion to major. On February 25, 1994, the day of the Jews' annual Purim festival, when each year they celebrate a massacre of 75,000 Persians, which they organized more than 2,500 years ago, as related in the Old Testament Book of Esther, Captain Goldstein entered a mosque in Hebron and murdered 29 Muslims who were kneeling in prayer, shooting them in the back with his army assault rifle. While he was reloading his assault rifle, surviving worshippers seized him and beat him to death. The Israeli government was not able to keep the massacre hushed up, and a major debate erupted in Israel, which continues to this day. On one side are the Orthodox Jews, who consider Goldstein a martyr and have made a shrine of his grave. On the other side are the non-religious Jews, such as Shadak, who are embarrassed by Goldstein's behavior and are worried about the Gentile reaction if the Gentiles ever figure out what the attitude of the religious Jews is. Immediately after the massacre, one very prominent Orthodox leader, Rabbi Moshe Levinger, told a writer for Israel's largest newspaper, Yediat Ahronot, that he was sorry for the 29 Palestinians murdered by Goldstein in the same way that he would be sorry for the killing of 29 flies. Another prominent Israeli religious leader, Rabbi Dov Lior, announced, and I quote, "Since Goldstein did what he did in God's own name, he is to be regarded as a righteous man." There was a huge funeral procession for Goldstein, and the Israeli army provided a guard of honor at his grave. Jewish children wore buttons with the slogan, "Dr. Goldstein cured Israel's ills." On the day of Goldstein's funeral, one of the eulogists, Rabbi Israel Ariel, said, and I quote, "The holy martyr, Baruch Goldstein, is from now on our intercessor in heaven." Goldstein did not act as an individual. He heard the cry of the land of Israel, which is being stolen from us day after day by the Muslims. He acted to relieve that cry of the land. A year after the massacre, the Israeli government issued a permit to Goldstein's admirers to build a large monument at the site of his grave. Today, 6 years after the massacre, Goldstein's grave is one of the most popular sites in Israel for religious Jewish tourists, especially those from the United States. Goldstein already has acquired the status of a saint. There are other examples in the book by Shehak and Mezvinsky illustrating what Orthodox Jews really believe and how they actually behave. One especially valuable point the authors make is that Jews habitually deceive Gentiles by having a different meaning in mind for the words they use than the meaning understood by Gentiles. When Orthodox Jewish writers use the term human beings, for example, they are referring only to Jews because the Talmud specifies that only Jews are human beings, while Gentiles, not having souls, are non-human animals. But the average Gentile doesn't realize this, and when he hears someone like Lieberman speaking of his compassion for his fellow human beings, he is fooled into believing that Lieberman is a man who has compassion for Gentiles as well as for Jews. It's really not possible to overemphasize the importance of this point. The Jews, in order to exercise their influence, must move among us and be regarded as more or less similar to us, whether they are religious or not. There are some exceptions to this. In New York, for example, there are communities of religious Jews who want to have nothing to do with Gentiles, except, of course, to take our money, sell us harmful drugs, and abuse our women through their involvement in the white slave trade, things which are perfectly in line with their religion. But as I said, some of them want to minimize their contact with us, and they deliberately distinguish themselves from Gentiles through their manner of dress and grooming, wearing long beards and side locks and fur hats, dressing only in black and so on. To us, they look weird. They give us the creeps. We are not surprised to see them spit three times whenever they pass a Christian church, or to give us cold, hard stares whenever we wander into one of their neighborhoods by mistake. But other religious Jews understand that they must mix with us in order to control us, and the ones who mix must disguise their beliefs and their purpose. So they pretend to be like us. They talk about ball games. They smile at us. They dress like us. They make jokes that we will laugh at. They come to our cocktail parties, and they lie to us about the nature of their religious beliefs. They behave like Joe Lieberman. But beneath the deceptive surface, they are the same as the greasiest, side-locked, black-clad kikes of New York's Orthodox neighborhoods, which is to say, they have the same religious beliefs, and those religious beliefs dominate their thinking and their behavior. There is only one Torah and only one Talmud, not a harsh, hate-filled Talmud for the Jews with side locks, and a gentler, kinder Talmud for Jews like Lieberman. Various groups of Orthodox Jews may wear different types of hats, but they all have the same religion. They all believe in the chosenness of the Jews. They all believe that Jews have been promised dominion over the earth and its inhabitants by their tribal God. That's what Joseph Isidore Lieberman really believes. Both Shehak and Mezvinsky are non-religious Jews, and their book reflects the very real struggle in Israel between religious Jews, Lieberman-type Jews, and non-religious Jews. The non-religious Jews really are worried that it will be bad for Israel if the behavior of the Orthodox Jews or their hateful and murderous attitudes become generally known. It certainly would be a mistake, however, for us to assume that the non-religious Jews in general are less deceitful or less a danger to us than religious Jews such as Lieberman. Shehak and Mezvinsky really represent only an extremely tiny minority of non-religious Jews. Marx and Trotsky and Kaganovich and all the other Jewish communist butchers who killed millions of our people in Europe were non-religious. And more to the point now, most of the media bosses in the United States are non-religious Jews, but that hardly makes them less deceitful. Have you heard or read any media commentary in the United States about the Goldstein massacre or the cult of Goldstein worshippers in Israel? Have you seen any discussion at all of the significance of Goldstein's choosing the Jews' Purim festival for his massacre? Compare this nearly total lack of coverage of the Goldstein phenomenon with, say, the famous Kristallnacht of November 1938 in Germany. After a Jew murdered a German official at the German embassy in Paris, Germans went on a rampage of retribution, smashing the windows of Jewish shops in Berlin and setting fire to synagogues. A total of 36 Jews were killed in the disorders, a figure not too different from the number of Palestinians slaughtered by Goldstein. Now, Kristallnacht was 62 years ago, and yet every American schoolchild still hears about it every year. It is our non-religious Jewish media bosses who are responsible for this gross distortion of the image of the world and of history, this vast overemphasis of some news and nearly total blackout of other news. That is really much more harmful to us than all of the Talmud-based hatred of the Orthodox Jews. It's good for our people to understand the nature of Judaism, to understand the beliefs of Orthodox Jews such as Lieberman. The best source for this sort of understanding is the Talmud, but for that very reason the Jews keep it out of sight as much as they can, and unless you are able to read Hebrew, you will find only Baudelaireized editions with the most revealing passages left out or deliberately mistranslated. That's why rare Jews such as Israel Shehak, who are willing for their own reasons to spill the beans on their fellow Jews, are so valuable to us. But we really must go beyond Judaism and understand that even those Jews who reject the Torah and the Talmud, the non-religious Jews, are our deadly enemies, although not our deadliest enemies. Our deadliest enemies are the traitors among our people. Our deadliest enemies are those of our own people who knowingly and deliberately collaborate with the Jews. Our deadliest enemies are the leaders of the Lutheran Church who conceal from their own people Luther's teachings about the Jews. Our deadliest enemies are the few remaining Gentile media bosses, Ted Turner, for example, or Rupert Murdoch, who, understanding what the Jews are like and what they are trying to do, nevertheless collaborate with them. Our deadliest enemies are the Gentile political leaders such as Albert Gore and George Bush, without whose conscious and willing collaboration, Jews such as Joseph Lieberman could pose no threat at all to us. Think about it. And thanks for being with me again today.